Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel relies on the generosity of our listeners to advance this vital gospel message about the coming kingdom. Please consider a donation to Beth Emmanuel, where Messianic Judaism is more than an idea. It's really happening.
Shimon Kifa addressed his first epistle to God's chosen people living as aliens in the diaspora in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, the province of Asia, and Bithynia. 1 Peter 1:1. This opening address unambiguously identifies his readers as Jewish. Unlike the Apostle Paul, who primarily addressed his epistles to Gentile disciples, the Apostle Peter assumes that his readers are Jewish disciples of Yeshua. Even the use of the term diaspora has a specific Jewish meaning. It's the same Greek word that the Torah uses to describe how God will exile the Jewish people and disperse them among the nations. It became a technical term to describe Jewish people living outside the land of Israel. This is why Peter refers to them as God's chosen people, that is, the elect, living as aliens and strangers in the diaspora. He specifically names five regions of the diaspora: Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, the province of Asia, and Bithynia. These place names describe the northern band of Asia Minor. Early Christian tradition identifies these regions as the apostolate of the brothers Peter and Andrew. That is, the part of the globe to which Peter and Andrew were dispatched. Here's what Eusebius says in his Ecclesiastical History, Book 3. Meanwhile, the holy apostles and disciples of our Savior were scattered over the whole world. Thomas, tradition tells us, was chosen for Parthia, Andrew for Scythia, John for Asia, where he remained till his death at Ephesus. Peter seems to have preached in Pontus, Galatia, and Bithynia, Cappadocia, and Asia, to the Jews of the diaspora. Notice that Eusebius says Peter preached to the Jews of the diaspora. The geography matters. We should note that this epistle was written to some of the same communities wherein the Apostle Paul had labored, such as the province of Galatia, to which he addressed his epistle to the Galatians. In Acts chapter 2, these locations are also specifically mentioned as nations containing Jewish populations. It says, "And how is it that we hear each of us in his own native language, Jews of Cappadocia, Pontus, and Asia?" Let me tell you a little bit about the Jewish communities in these regions. Cappadocia occupied the great plateau of central Anatolia. The Halys River traversed the plateau. The upper Euphrates served as Cappadocia's eastern border. The Taurus Mountains bounded it on the south, and Galatia, Bithynia, and Pontus bordered it on the west and north. Cappadocia possessed few cities, only two in the first century, apart from small villages and agricultural settlements. It had a Jewish community before 142 BCE. A letter sent to Cappadocia from a Roman consul notifies various kings and peoples of Rome's treaty with and support for the Jewish people and forbade harassing local Jewish populations. In the days of the apostles, Cappadocia contained a large Jewish community with many respected sages, and this continued into later centuries, as evidenced by various references in Jewish literature to Cappadocia. Pontus was originally the Greek name of the Black Sea, but it was also a kingdom occupying the southern coast of the Black Sea. Rome joined parts of Pontus to the province of Galatia Cappadocia. The Jewish believer Aquila originally came from the Jewish community of Pontus. In later years, the Pontic Jewish community produced Greek translations of the Hebrew scriptures as alternatives to the Septuagint. Asia. The name Asia refers not to the continent of Asia, but rather to Asia Minor, that is, the Greek cities along the Aegean coast together with the territory adjacent to them. Asia and its various regions, Mysia, Lydia, Caria, and Lycia, all had Jewish populations. The cities of Asia Minor contained Greek-speaking Jewish communities. In the early apostolic era, King Herod Agrippa sent a letter to Emperor Gaius in which he specifically mentions these locations as part of the Jewish diaspora as follows. He says, "Jews dwell in Egypt, Phoenicia, generally throughout Syria, and particularly the part that is called Coele-Syria, and also in those more remote regions of Pamphylia, Cilicia, most of Asia Minor, as far as Bithynia, and the far reaches of Pontus." Long story short, there were plenty of Jews in Pontus, Galatia, Bithynia, Cappadocia, and Asia for Peter to address. Any uncertainty about the Jewish identity of his readers should be dispelled by the time we reach the second chapter of the epistle, where he says, "You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession." 1 Peter 2:9. The Torah uses those appellations to describe Israel and to distinguish the Jewish people from the Gentile nations. Exodus 19:5-6. It's preposterous to imagine that Simon Peter would reassign those descriptions to people who are not Jewish. Given all of this evidence, why do so many readers prefer to think that the words of 1 Peter describe Gentile Christians instead of Jewish believers? The underlying assumptions of replacement theology make it difficult for many readers to allow that Peter might be describing Jews the same way that the Torah described them. From the perspective of replacement theology, the Torah has been canceled and the covenant God made with Israel is defunct. The church has replaced Israel as the people of God. Therefore, it's no great leap to imagine Peter reassigning the appellations once used to describe Israel to the church. But there's something else, some internal evidence that creates some confusion about the identity of the readers. In addition to the theological bias inherited from the church's preference for replacing Jewish identity with Christian identity, there's evidence within the epistle to suggest that the readers actually were Gentiles at one time. We will take a look at that in a moment. When I first began attending a Messianic Jewish synagogue in the early 1990s, I attended a men's breakfast and Bible study on Sunday mornings once a month. We gathered at the restaurant called the Old Country Buffet. It was not a kosher establishment, but none of the men were Jewish, and none of us really knew the difference. The ham and bacon made some of the fellows a little uncomfortable. The Messianic rabbi carefully avoided that. A few of us nervously joked about the name of the place, referring to it as the Old Kosher Buffet. The Messianic rabbi allowed us to take turns leading the men's Bible study. When my turn came around, I selected 1 Peter specifically because of the identity language. I pointed out that Peter regards his readership as Jewish. He contrasts them against Gentiles when he says, "Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable." 1 Peter 2:12. I pointed out the Israel-specific language he applies to his readers, God's elect, scattered in the diaspora, a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a people for his own possession. I showed the men that this language unambiguously refers to Israel when it appears in the Torah. But then I turned their attention to a passage which seems to imply the opposite. It implies that people addressed in the epistle were not ethnically Jewish. Before becoming believers in Yeshua, the readers of the epistle had lived godless Gentile lives. 1 Peter 4:3 says, "For the time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles do, living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry." Moreover, Peter quotes the prophet Hosea and declares to his readers, "Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." 1 Peter 2:10. This implies that his readers underwent a change in identity, Prior to their encounter with the Messiah, they were not a people, but subsequent to their encounter with the Messiah, they had become the people of God, that is, Israel. I assembled all of this evidence to make the case that after becoming a disciple of Yeshua, a Gentile Christian should be reckoned as a member of the nation of Israel. I correlated that conclusion with Paul's language about being grafted in Romans 11, and some of his statements about there being no difference between Jew and Greek. On top of all that, Peter tells his readers to live holy lives, and he quotes the passage in the Torah which says, "You shall be holy, for I am holy." On that basis, I suggested that all of the Torah's standards of holiness should apply equally to both Jews and Gentile Christians. By the end of the Bible study, I had made a strong case that we were all, essentially, de facto Jews. That's the line of argument that ultimately led me to accept the wrong-headed propositions of one-law theology, the theological conviction that the laws of the Torah apply equally to both Jewish people and to Gentile Christians. But I could have just as easily followed the same logic as an argument for replacement theology to prove that the church is the new Israel. That's probably how a lot of people arrive at the conviction that Christianity has replaced Judaism. If you read 1 Peter as if it is written to Gentile Christians, you would conclude that Gentile Christians have become the treasured possession among all peoples, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, that is to say, the new Israel. But that's not what Peter is saying. He was not saying that Gentile disciples should think of themselves as Jews, nor was he saying that the Gentile church should regard itself as the new Israel. He was not speaking to Gentiles. He was speaking to ex-Gentiles. For the sake of review, let me briefly summarize the argument between Peter and Paul that we have been following. Peter and Paul disagreed on how to direct the Gentile disciples of Yeshua. Peter believed that they should be directed to become Jewish through a conventional legal conversion that included circumcision and entrance into the covenant. When that happened, Peter's Gentile converts ceased to be Gentiles and became Jewish. That's why Peter was called the apostle to the circumcision, because his disciples underwent circumcision to become Jewish. Paul believed that they should not become Jewish, but that they should remain in the state in which they were called. He believed that they should keep only those laws of the Torah that applied universally. He argued against Gentile disciples taking on Jewish identity by becoming circumcised and circumcising their children. That is why he was called the apostle to the uncircumcised and apostle to the Gentiles. Ultimately, the apostles resolved their difference of opinion at the Jerusalem Council of Acts 15 with a compromise whereby Gentile disciples would not be required to become Jewish, but would be regarded as strangers in the midst of Israel, as explained in previous teachings. Paul seems to have taken that ruling a step further and prohibited Gentiles from becoming Jewish. He called that his rule for all assemblies. Each one should remain in the condition in which he was called. 1 Corinthians 7:20, see 7:17 through 20. But did Peter also adopt Paul's stringency? Did he hold Gentile disciples to Paul's one rule for all the assemblies? Probably not. More likely, Peter continued to allow Gentile disciples to become Jewish and join themselves to the Jewish nation if they wanted to do so. He agreed that the disciples from the nations need not become Jewish as a criteria to obtain the kingdom in the world to come. He agreed that it was not fair to force the Gentiles turning to God to bear a yoke which the Jewish people had been unable to bear. But he did not agree to forbid Gentile disciples from becoming Jewish if they wanted to do so. And many of them did want to do so. Paul's epistle to the Galatians indicates that many Gentile disciples in Galatia did want to become Jewish. Moreover, they pressured other Gentile disciples to do so as well. It appears that Peter, the apostle to the circumcised, did not have a problem with that. Gentile disciples in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia had some powerful motivations for becoming Jewish and to being numbered among the Jewish people. Jews under Roman rule enjoyed the freedom to practice their own religion with social protections under Roman law since the time of Simon the High Priest. The book of 1 Maccabees records the text of a Roman edict issued to the territories of Asia Minor regarding the Jews. It says, "We thought it good, therefore, to write unto the kings and countries that they should do the Jews no harm, nor fight against them, their cities or countries, nor yet aid their enemies against them. If, therefore, there be any pestilent fellows that have fled from their country unto you, deliver them unto Simon the high priest, that he may punish them, according to their own law." The same protections did not apply to Gentile disciples of Yeshua. As Yeshua followers and God-fearing Gentiles who rejected idolatry, their Gentile identity left them vulnerable to social persecution and ostracization. Renouncing idolatry left them without the support of a social circle. Monotheists were castigated as atheists. Since they were not Jewish, they could be forced by civil authorities to worship the gods or to observe any number of idolatrous functions. They had no social protections whatsoever. Their best option was to become Jewish, or to use Paul's terminology, to join the circumcision, a term which seems to imply converts. If we assume that the majority of the readers to whom the apostle to the circumcised addressed his epistles are former Gentiles who, after becoming Yeshua followers, have also undergone some type of conversion to join the Jewish nation, all of the epistles' internal difficulties disappear. The whole thing snaps into focus. Peter warns his readers against indulging in sins from their former Gentile way of life when they lived in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry. He tells them that now that they are Jewish, they must keep their conduct among the Gentiles honorable. He reminds them that previously they were not a people, but now they have become God's people as members of the nation of Israel. He tells them to live according to the Torah's laws of holiness because now that they are Jewish, they are obligated to do so. They have become a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. It's like reading the other side of the argument that Paul makes in Galatians. I believe that Peter has the rubrics of the conversion ceremony in mind when he blesses God for causing us to be born again to a living hope. "Blessed be the God and Father of our Master Yeshua the Messiah, who, according to his great mercy, has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Yeshua the Messiah from the dead, for an inheritance that is incorruptible, undefiled, and unfading, reserved in heaven for you, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time." 1 Peter 1, 3-5. Obviously, he is speaking about the hope of the resurrection. But the term born again likely alludes to the conversion ceremony that his proselytes underwent when they became believers and subsequently became Jewish. The term born again was not coined in the late 1970s when it began to appear in American media and on bumper stickers, nor was it invented by Yeshua and the New Testament writers. Instead, it seems to have been a term that originally functioned in Judaism to describe Gentiles who had undergone conversion rituals to be born again as Jews. That's how the term seems to be used in the Talmud. A Gentile who wants to become Jewish through conversion must undergo several ritual requirements. For men, the two main requirements are circumcision and immersion. For a woman, immersion itself is the entire conversion ritual. Even after circumcision, a Gentile who converts to become Jewish remains Gentile until he comes up out of the water of immersion, out of the pool, the mikvah. The convert symbolically dives as he descends into the water. He emerges from the water as a newborn child. The Talmud says, when he comes up after his immersion, he is deemed an Israelite in all respects. Rabbi Yossi said, one who has become a proselyte is like a child newly born. According to Aryeh Kaplan's book, The Waters of Eden, emerging from the mikveh symbolizes rebirth. The mikveh can be said to represent the womb. Going into the mikveh is like re-entering the womb, entering the place of God's creative power. Emerging from the water of the mikveh is like being born again. It represents a change in status. Moreover, Kaplan says that immersion in a mikveh also represents death and resurrection. Just as a person cannot breathe underwater and so enters a death-like state while under the water, a person entering the mikveh is like a person entering the grave. When he comes up out of the water, he comes back to life. Just as the mikveh represents the grave, Jewish tradition holds that a mikveh must be built directly into the ground. The Talmud describes the proselyte as one reborn. The sages took the legal transformation quite literally. Gentiles, born again as Jews, have no kin. In a legal sense, they are new creatures. Old family ties and relations are defunct. The convert legally dies and comes back to life. Understanding that the term born again originally referred to a Gentile who had undergone a legal conversion to become Jewish and joined the Jewish nation sheds light on John 3, where the master tells Nicodemus that he must be born again. Nicodemus objects, how can a man be born when he is old? He cannot enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born, can he? John 3:4. If the term born again already functioned in Jewish parlance as a way of referring to a Gentile who had become Jewish through the waters of immersion, we should understand the objection in the same terms. When Nicodemus rhetorically asks, how can a man be born when he is old? He employs the same metaphoric terminology. In other words, Nicodemus objected, I am already Jewish. How can I undergo a conversion to become Jewish? Yeshua replies, a man must be born of water and spirit. He warns Nicodemus not to rely on his national identity. The criteria for entrance into the Messianic era involves a spiritual transformation and the resurrection of the dead. To be born again means to be born twice. Once into this world when your mother gives birth to you, born of water. Once into the world to come, when you rise from the dead, born of spirit. In the teaching of Yeshua and the apostles, therefore, to be born again means to be resurrected for the world to come. Those who are born into this world are born as the son or daughter of so-and-so, but those who are born again are born into the world to come as the son or the daughter of Hashem, sons of God, daughters of God. The Apostle Peter declares that, as sons and daughters, you will receive an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you, a share in the world to come, the born-again world. We see the same concept preserved and transmitted in Clementine Homilies, a collection of Ebionite teachings, which allegedly preserves the teaching of Peter. According to the homilies, this world is likened to the mother, and the world to come is likened to the Father. Why? Because this world bears sons and daughters for the world to come. Under this analogy, the human soul enters this world from a source in the world to come and impregnates this current age like seed planted in the soil. The human being gestates in this world of flesh, blood, and physicality. The day of birth, then, corresponds to the day of the resurrection of the dead. The dead are born again into the world to come. As Yeshua says, do not be amazed that I said to you, you must be born again. When Peter says, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Yeshua the Messiah from the dead, He was not speaking about the legal conversion to become Jewish, but rather about being born again for the resurrection of the dead and the reward of eternal life in the world to come. In that sense, his words apply to every disciple of Yeshua. The living hope, to which we are born again, is a hope for all disciples of Yeshua, Jew and Gentile, male and female, slave and free. But for Peter's disciples, the term born again carried extra weight and additional significance in that they understood their national conversion to become Jewish as a component of their discipleship to Yeshua. Remember, Peter is not Paul. Peter seems to have conflated the immersion of the disciples of Yeshua with the national conversion ritual to become Jewish. He probably did so on the basis of Yeshua's directive to go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. Matthew 28:19-20. How else was he to understand that directive, if not in terms of converting the Gentiles? I believe this was Peter's perspective on the matter. A Gentile who renounces idolatry to follow the King of the Jews is to be welcomed into the nation of Israel as a proselyte. As we have seen, Paul understood things differently, and he insisted on making a distinction between Jewish disciples and Gentile disciples. Ultimately, Simon Peter conceded to Paul's argument and also to the compromise laid out in Acts 15. Nevertheless, his first epistle still assumes that the majority of his readers are former Gentiles who now, as followers of Yeshua, have been legally born again as Jews. Peter reminds them that they have also been spiritually born again, according to the foreknowledge of God the Father, in the sanctification of the Spirit, for obedience to Yeshua the Messiah, by sprinkling with his blood. 1 Peter 1:2. Be extremely careful not to misunderstand what we are learning here. This does not mean, on any level, that we should regard Gentile disciples of Yeshua as proselytes or de facto Jews. We are not going to rob Peter to pay Paul, nor are we going to throw out Paul for the sake of reading Peter. The epistle of 1 Peter should not be used as an excuse to ignore distinction between Jewish and Gentile identity. It should not be utilized to controvert Paul's rule for all the assemblies. Nor should we utilize it as an argument for one law theology or replacement theology. Instead, we should understand the epistle of 1 Peter as the epistle to the proselytes, the epistle to the converts. It's addressed to former Gentile idolaters and God-fearers who, after hearing about Yeshua and the coming kingdom, underwent a legal conversion to join the nation of Israel. It is addressed to those people who accepted the argument made in Acts 15:5. It is necessary to circumcise them and to direct them to observe the law of Moses. Peter considered himself an apostle to the circumcised, meaning an apostle to the proselytes from the nations. In that regard, the epistle of 1 Peter should be especially precious to those who have come under the wings of the Shekinah through legal conversion to join the nation of Israel as disciples of Yeshua. Some of you have done so to reconcile a mixed marriage. Some of you to reconcile mixed ancestry. Some of you to reconcile uncertain legal status. The epistle of 1 Peter rightly belongs to you. It's speaking directly to your situation. Unlike Paul's epistles, which are addressed primarily to Gentile disciples like myself, Peter speaks directly to you. He wants to remind you that you have been born again, not only in legal terms as one legally reborn as a Jew and a member of the nation, but you have also been born again through the sanctification of the Spirit, through obedience to the Messiah, and through the sprinkling of his blood, reborn for the resurrection of the body in the world to come. This is the living hope. Fix your mind upon it. Just as you were born twice, first a Gentile and reborn Jewish, so too you are born twice, first a child of this world and then reborn as a child of the world to come. This same living hope belongs to all of us who cling to Yeshua. It is a hope made possible through the resurrection of Yeshua the Messiah from the dead, into which all of us are being born again as sons and daughters of God, heirs of an inheritance of salvation which remains preserved for us in heaven and yet to be revealed here on earth on the last day.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.